Good evening and welcome to the Cybersecurity and Cryptocurrency Podcast. I'm your host, Eric English. Today is Tuesday, August the 28th of 2018. We're on episode 23. Quite a bit of things to talk about today in both cybersecurity and crypto news. So I'll jump right into it. I do want to first thank our sponsor, Southern Graphics T-Shirt Company, for all your T-shirt needs. If you need business shirts made or any kind of custom T-shirts designed, Southern Graphics can do that for you. Their website is southerngraphicst-shirtco.com. Again, southerngraphicst-shirtco.com. Go check them out. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I am at eenglish34 on Twitter. Again, at eenglish34 on Twitter if you want to follow me there. All right. So, there was a huge zero-day vulnerability that's been spotted in the wild. And everybody's kind of freaking out about it, going, oh my God, the world is ending. What are we going to do? And while that's all well and good, Microsoft, I don't believe, has even patched it yet. So people are definitely freaking out about this. I will post the article to the show notes so everybody can check it out. But pretty big zero-day exploit, apparently, and it's been exploited in the wild. They're seeing quite a bit of this out there now. So definitely scary stuff. So check out that article, and hopefully they update that article again and show the link to update from whenever Microsoft actually releases a fix for it. At the time of reading, which was this morning when I read it, there was no Microsoft update for it yet. But knowing them, they're usually pretty quick and they'll jump all over it and get us an update. And heck, it may have already been there, been posted today, and I just haven't gotten around to looking at it yet before the show, because I've been actually working. But anyway, check out that zero day. It's big news today, so check that out. Make sure you patch everything. Even US CERT came out and said it was a big risk and all kinds of other stuff, so make sure you're patching that one. Twitter, our good friends at Twitter, suspended a bunch of accounts for some coordinated manipulation, and essentially it was coordinated manipulation trying to get people to vote a certain way, or, you know, it's the same thing they were doing on Facebook, essentially. They're trying to persuade people to do certain things depending on their agenda. And so Twitter actually is fighting back now and has suspended some of those accounts. How many accounts, I'm not sure. But I do think it's good that these social media networks are actually, you know, getting in there. And I mean, Twitter especially. Twitter's just kind of wide open, or at least it used to be. But anyway, they suspended 284 accounts, and they just called it coordinated manipulation. So they also blamed Iran for a whole bunch of it, and they're just calling it a misinformation network. So pretty interesting stuff there. We don't typically see Twitter doing this, so that's why it was a little shocking, I guess, at first, but I think it's good that they're doing this. Get all this fake news off of these platforms, because the fake news is really what drives people to do things that they probably shouldn't, or to have opinions they probably shouldn't. So I think it's going to do nothing but help. And I think with Facebook and Twitter doing the same thing, that's definitely a good sign. 284 accounts doesn't seem like a lot to me with all the Twitter users. There's got to be quite a few more, I would assume, that are doing this. But, you know, I'm not the Twitter folks, and I don't have those numbers. But my suspicion is there's going to be a lot more accounts that are going to get suspended if they continue down this road. They got a lot of kickback and flack for suspending these accounts from the Twitter community. I'm not really sure what everybody's problem is. I mean, if they're manipulating people and sending out, you know, fake news crap, why do people care if these accounts are suspended or not? You know, to me, you'd want those to be suspended. You don't want to have to look at that kind of junk. But anyway, that was pretty interesting stuff to see Twitter actually taking those down now. So that's good. Hopefully we can get all this fake news out of our freaking timelines. Getting ridiculous. Some other news, since I used to work with a lot of different banks, there was a pretty big vulnerability with Fiserv. And Fiserv is what's called a core banking provider. They essentially provide all the core banking, and they, you know, secure all the transactions and process all the transactions that happen at a bank. And typically it's for the smaller banks that can't afford to, you know, build their own core processing system. So they host it for them, or, you know, maybe they have an on-prem instance, but it syncs with a hosted environment. But Fiserv essentially provides that to people. It's just the core of all the transactions that are happening. You can kind of think of it as a pseudo blockchain of sorts, but they had a pretty big flaw in their online banking application. Krebszon Security kind of did some additional investigation on this, and I thought it was pretty interesting to see. The original person that reported it to Krebs said that he was able to get full account numbers, email addresses, and phone numbers. Now, I thought that was pretty interesting, too. You don't typically see that, but apparently you could get all that information from there, which is pretty interesting. You could do it from the website, and or the online banking website, excuse me. And essentially, you change one digit in the URL, and you're able to see other alerts that were sent to other users and other accounts. Now, the original guy that reported it to Krebs said that he could see the full account numbers. Krebs tested it and said, no, I only see truncated passwords. Or, I'm sorry, account numbers. So I'm not sure what the difference was there, unless it was just the particular bank that, you know, the original guy was a part of. I'm not sure what that is, but anyway, I thought that was rather crazy news to hear about, and, you know, who knows how long this flaw has been there. They did patch it right away, so kudos to Fiserv for getting right on that. I think that's great. They do take security very, very seriously, and so that's definitely a good thing that they were all over it as soon as they heard about it. So that's definitely good, but this affected about 1,700 community banks. Now, that's a pretty damn huge number, if you think about it. You know, there's probably 100 and, no, probably more than that. It's probably 200 or 300 at least different banks per state. There's so many banks that are around now. In every corner that you go to, there's a bank, essentially, and it's always First National Bank or First Bank of whatever city, or First Bank and Trust of whatever city, so they're all over the place, and to hear that 1,700 of these banks were potentially affected by this vulnerability, that's pretty scary. The other scary part is that we don't know if this vulnerability was actually, you know, being actively exploited. Apparently, you could edit the alerts that were going out and redirect them to a different email address and a different phone number. What's still unclear is if you could redirect like a 2FA or two-factor code of some sort. That was not disclosed in this article. But it's at least account alerts where you set up, you know, like, hey, your checking account's less than $50, send me an alert kind of thing. But I do wonder if those accounts and this vulnerability would have let somebody get a two-factor authentication code. If so, that's pretty scary. But they have not disclosed that yet. So, but kudos to Fiserv. They did go in there and fix it within 24 hours of it being reported to them. So you can no longer see other customers' data when you're doing your online banking through a Fiserv platform. If you bank with any community banks and you're wondering if they use Fiserv, typically on the when you log into their online banking, it'll say, you know, provided by Fiserv or hosted by Fiserv somewhere on the online banking page. So you can check that out and see if your bank uses Fiserv. I look at this also a couple of different ways. You know, I worked with banks that they're being scrutinized left and right by the OCC and the FDIC, and they're scrutinizing every little thing that they do. And if you don't have your policy written this particular way, then you're in trouble. We're going to write you up. We're going to shut your bank down. You know, all these crazy threats that they make because your policy doesn't have the right words in it. And oftentimes they skip over a lot of the technical controls. Now, they've recently changed that and they are doing a lot more of the technical stuff, which is good. But they're scrutinizing the banks so much. And Fiserv gets audited by the same companies. They get audited by the OCC and I believe FDIC as well. So I don't know if they just weren't being scrutinized enough or if they just didn't do any actual security testing on their platform, which to me is a pretty big no-no. I don't know why you would not do that as part of your audit, especially if you're reviewing technical things in the audit. You should be checking all the controls and looking at the website and going to different pages and seeing what you can do, whether the website is online banking or just the primary domain, whatever it is. As an auditor, you want to go through every little thing that you can with a fine-tooth comb, and usually they do. But oftentimes they come back and say, well, your policy says these three words, and it really should say these other three words. Or they want you to combine policies together. I mean, it's really, really, really crazy what some of these examiners make banks do. They make them jump through all these hoops. But yet, here goes Fiserv with this huge vulnerability just sitting out there. 1,700 banks were affected. Hello. I hate the fact that those regulatory bodies come down so hard on the bankers that are just trying to, you know, serve their customers and do a good job with customer service. And these regulators come in and audit the crap out of them. It's pretty much a constant audit all year going on with these banks. And I just feel bad for them because each regulator that you get is going to have a different opinion, and some are going to understand technology more than others, and some may not understand it at all. There's some big issues with the way that the regulators do it, and the guidance that they follow is not very specific. It's pretty generic. So that's also frustrating for the bankers because you don't know, you know, what exactly does this vague wording mean that I have to do to be compliant? And they oftentimes don't tell you. The other thing that, just speaking of compliance and whatnot, just because you are compliant doesn't mean that you're actually secure. The FFIEC guidance was, last time I looked at it, which has been at least a year and a half now, but last time I looked at it, it was really, really outdated and really didn't show any signs of being updated. They updated a couple of sections in that guidance, but it was pretty few and far between at the time. And so if you're going off of guidance that's from, you know, 2008, well, I mean, it's 10 years later, folks. Technology has completely changed 100% since 2008. I mean, we are in a totally different age of technology since 2008. So they need to update their guidance. These regulators need to be more firm on what they want. But if you are a banker and you are compliant, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're as secure as you can be either. There's always a way, always something else you can be doing to help mitigate threats. One of the things that I like to do with any job that I go to, once I've been indoctrinated into the environment and I kind of understand how everything works, I like to go and look for the big targets and also do a little bit of investigation similar to what an internal pen tester would do, and see what is out there, see what's available, see what's hackable, and then determine, okay, what type of attack would I do in this situation? Okay, now I'm going to step back and say, okay, I'm the blue team guy, so how do I prevent this attack? And so that's kind of the approach that I took with pretty much every job that I went to, whether it was consulting or an actual full-time gig, doesn't matter. I always thought like the attacker first, and then you stop and say, okay, how do I prevent this guy from hacking in? Typically, there's always a way to mitigate any sort of attack, like Mimikatz and things like that. There's always a way to help prevent it. Of course, it's never perfect, but there are ways to help prevent those kinds of attacks. But if you read any kind of internal pen testing blogs and the type of attacks that they do, that'll give you a great starting point for things that you should look at doing in your environment to make you more secure. Especially if you see a trend on those blog sites that have internal pen testing information about just, you know, generically what they did. They may not tell you all the nitty-gritty details, which they shouldn't, but at least you can see what types of attacks they do. And if you see that same type of attack on multiple different sites, then you know that that one's pretty common and pretty commonly exposed. And most people are vulnerable to that. So that's also a great place to start. If you're looking to, you know, secure your environment, you don't really know where to start, I think the first thing you want to do, very first step when you get into an environment, is take an inventory and find out what your critical assets are, your high-value targets are, you know, what systems are high-value targets, and have that list of high-value targets, and then understand what information is on those systems and what services are running and how they could be exploited. And then what controls can you put in place on those high-value targets to help mitigate these types of attacks? That's a good place to start at the very, very beginning. Get that HVT list, high-value target list, and work your way from there. Once you've secured the high-value targets as much as you think you can, then, of course, you can focus on the other endpoints in your environment as well. But high-value targets is certainly a great place to start. If nothing else, you should have a high-value target list and just understand what your most critical systems are. So, you know, you need that for not only security purposes, but redundancy and disaster recovery type of purposes, too. You need to know what your critical systems are in your infrastructure. So create that high-value target list. And now, HVT list doesn't have to be just computers. It can be your CEO, CFO, any other executives at your company. They're high-value targets, right? Hackers can fish them and do some spear phishing and try to get, you know, the CEO to click on something or the CFO to click on something. So they are also high-value targets. So not just, you know, servers and workstations as being high-value targets. Make sure that that list includes people as well. But once you've got that high-value target list, then you can really decide how to secure everything in your environment. I got off on a tangent there, but going back to the whole thing with Fiserv, it is patched, so that's good. Sorry to go off on a tangent like that. Back to other cybersecurity news. There was an article published on ZDNet about, I thought this was pretty funny, why Facebook is powerless to stop its own descent. And you've seen the hashtag delete Facebook movement. It's getting pretty prevalent, especially on Twitter. Lots of people are moving away from Facebook. And every day you turn around, there's always some new privacy issue that's coming up with Facebook. The VPN was the most recent one that we talked about yesterday. And there's a lot more, too. There's these quiz apps that they're still finding that are, you know, misusing everybody's data, essentially, and everybody's personal information. Facebook is just in that downward spiral right now, and I just don't know that they can get out of it at this point. They really should just remove all plugins and apps from their site and just reevaluate, starting from ground zero. Just pull all those quizzes and crap. Don't let people do that. Pull all of those, every single one of them, or poll questions or quizzes or, you know, how will you die type of things. Pull all that stuff from your site. Don't let people do that. Don't let the integrations where you're allowing some third-party app to access your profile. Facebook should just turn that off. Just in general, I think. And then start from ground zero. Only allow certain ones that you've fully vetted to be able to do that. Have access to your profile, that is, from a third party. Vet out those third parties. Make sure that you're very, very comfortable with them. This is what Facebook should do, not you necessarily. But once Facebook has determined that, yes, these people are good and they're not going to misuse the data, then you open it up for that one particular third-party plugin. Oftentimes, too, you'll see, you know, on various sites, log in with Facebook or log in with Google. That is not a good idea. And why I say that's not a good idea, primarily because you're essentially using Facebook as a single sign-on, right? Think about all the privacy issues we just talked about, right? So when you do single sign-on with whatever website it is that's saying that you can log in with Facebook, Facebook is then accessing the site, and they could be tracking what you're doing on whatever site that is that you just logged into. They seem to not care about privacy, so who's to say that they're not doing that? So think about those kinds of things when you log in or you create an account for a site that uses the, you know, log in with Facebook thing. I always choose, you know, log in with an alternate method. And create a separate account, use a unique password. The other issue there with using the Facebook one is if your Facebook password gets leaked, well, whatever other sites that you were using that were allowing you to log in with Facebook, guess what? They can also get into those accounts as well. So that's why it's always so freaking important to have unique passwords everywhere you go, every site that you go to. I know it's a pain in the butt, but it's so pertinent that we all do this and store them in a password manager like Dashlane. You know, that way you don't have to worry about forgetting it. Dashlane does it for you. It's okay. I highly recommend getting a password manager solution of some sort. Doesn't matter what it is, just get one. Use unique passwords everywhere. Don't log in with Facebook. And don't log in with Google either. You know, we haven't heard as many privacy issues with Google, although they did have one about their location tracking recently, where if you turned off location services, it didn't necessarily disable your location settings globally on your phone, at least. But we haven't heard much else about Google and any privacy issues that they might have. But that's not to say that they don't have any. You know, they may have just not been uncovered yet. And if you log into a site with Google, maybe Google's tracking that too. So, and the same thing goes with if your Google password gets hacked, then they'd have access to all the other sites that you've logged in with Google. So, those are definitely some pretty big risks that you can be taking. But, you know, again, it's up to you what you want to do. If the site that you're signing into Facebook with, you don't give a crap about and it doesn't have any information out there that you're too worried about, then yeah, go ahead. Whatever. It's fine. But get a password manager, store it in your password manager, and that way you don't have to worry about this kind of stuff. It just makes life way easier. All right. So, that's really all I had for cybersecurity news. We'll jump over to crypto news. There's a company called Open Finance, and they just started their own regulated trading platform for security tokens. Now, what the heck does that mean? I'm not really sure. I haven't actually seen this platform at work yet. I'm going to try to sign up for it as soon as I get home tonight so I can check it out and see what they're doing. I also want to dig into what exactly they're regulating, how it's being regulated, because there's no official regulatory body that presides over these cryptocurrency exchanges or any other types of cryptocurrency markets or security tokens or whatever. There's currently no regulation whatsoever, so it is good to see that people are moving that direction, but I haven't seen what exactly they're doing yet. But I am going to look at it, and I can report back once I've checked that out. But check out Open Finance if you haven't already. I'll post that link in the show notes as well. And great news for all you traders out there. Bitcoin was up above 7,000 today. We haven't seen 7,000 in a couple of months. So this is great news for all the traders out there. And as everybody knows, as Bitcoin goes up and down, all the other cryptocurrencies go up and down as well. It's pretty incredible what Bitcoin does to the rest of the market. But the reason for that is because all the exchanges, everywhere you go, you're exchanging it typically for Bitcoin or Ethereum in most places that you go on these exchanges. So all the altcoins take a hit. All of the, pretty much all coins take a hit when Bitcoin goes up or down. They take a hit when going down. Obviously, they do much better when it's going up. So it's great to see that we were up above 7,000 for the first time in a few months. So that is great for all of you traders out there. So really, really cool stuff there. And hopefully it just continues that upward trend. I keep saying it, so maybe it's working. Hopefully the ETF decisions won't jack with it again, and hopefully we can just keep this trend going. There was some other news about Ripple, and I thought this was really interesting. Ripple claims that they are decentralized. Now, I thought that Stellar Lumens was created because they were decentralized, and one of the guys that helped start Ripple did not like the fact that they were centralized. And there was an article published today by Ripple basically stating that they are decentralized, and the validation or verification servers that they have are controlled by multiple other third parties, and therefore that makes them decentralized. I thought that was rather interesting. Decentralized essentially means that you can hold people accountable. So think about it this way. Let's just start with the basics. Blockchain is a ledger of transactions that cannot be modified. It can only be added to. You can't go back and edit, right? So when you think about that with decentralization and accountability, if millions of computers have a copy of this ledger and somebody tries to go back and edit an older transaction that's already occurred, that's already been, you know, published on the blockchain, it's going to, the blockchain is going to go out and verify this transaction with all of the other nodes that have a copy of the blockchain, and you know, they're going to get overridden because the majority of them are not going to have this edited transaction on them. And so therefore they would just make it null and void and they'd cancel that transaction. So you can't go back and edit. So it provides a sort of accountability, meaning that you can't go back and manipulate things on the fly. So Ripple originally, and I think they even said it, that they were centralized because they needed in some circumstances to go back and do whatever it was. I really don't know how to feel about them saying that they're decentralized. I don't really have any way of validating that those verification servers are actually hosted by third parties that they don't have any sort of relationships with. I am going to see if I can spin up my own verification server for Ripple, just to see, you know, see if they truly are decentralized. But Stellar Lumens was created because the one of the guys that helped create Ripple didn't like it because it was centralized. So anyway, I thought that was really, really interesting, and I guess it makes me feel better about Ripple. I don't really know. Ripple was trading around 34 cents today. It was up a little bit from yesterday. But I'm not really sure still how that makes me feel about Ripple. I do invest in Ripple, and I've definitely bought a whole lot more since the price is so far down right now. I've been buying tons of it just to sit on it and hope that it goes back up to a dollar or two, and then I'll sell it again. But right now it's pretty low, so if you're looking to get into Ripple, now is definitely the time, because you can get it at pretty much a steal. And if the market does bounce back to where anywhere near what it was last year at about this time, then Ripple's going to be doing pretty damn well, along with all the other coins too. But I wonder how this news is going to affect the public's perception of Ripple as well. Will they have more faith in them and trust them more? That I don't know. But I also wonder what Stellar Lumens thinks about this as well. But I don't have those answers, unfortunately. So other cryptocurrency news, it also kind of relates to cybersecurity as well. Hackers breached a platform called Atlas Quantum. It's apparently a cryptocurrency exchange. Now, the hackers did not get away with any crypto, but they did get away with various account numbers and account settings and account details, passwords, usernames, all that kind of fun stuff. So they made off with the customer database, but no actual cryptocurrency. That's kind of a change. You know, typically we've seen these guys make off with all kinds of crypto and they don't care about anything else. So I thought that was rather interesting that they heisted all the details there. Now, probably what they're going to use that for, you know, by nature, people reuse their same passwords. So they're probably going to do a password spray on another exchange and see if these passwords work on any other exchange sites. You know, they just might. Hopefully everybody's got two factors set up on those exchange sites. I think most of those exchanges now require the two factor setup, at least the ones that I've subscribed to. But either way, they're probably going to try these codes or these passwords They won't have any two-factor codes, but from there they can do some social engineering and try to social engineer that two-factor code away from whoever's account that they know that they've got the password for. So that'll be interesting to see what happens with those passwords. So as soon as I hear some news about that, I'll follow this up and we'll talk about it again on here. But it's all the news that I had for today. We're still working on the Mimikatz stuff at my current gig, so I will talk about that again once we figured out our game plan, but we're still kind of in the works on that. But in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at eEnglish34, and I retweet all these articles that we talk about on the show, so you can follow me on there, eEnglish34. And I also published a guide on hardening Office 365, like we talked about on a previous podcast. All the mitigations that I did, I basically wrote it down and put it into a blog, and it's available on my website, which is ericenglish.com, if you want to go look at that article. I'll also post it in the show notes, so you can just click right on it if you want to check that out. But hardening Office 365 is definitely a good idea, and I wrote down everything that we did at my job. So hopefully it helps somebody else do the same thing. Check out our sponsor, too, Southern Graphics T-Shirt Company. Their website's southerngraphicst-shirtco.com. Check them out for all your T-shirt needs. That's all I got for today, folks. Thanks for listening.